Welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. I'm very excited to be joined today by Dr. Jace Weaver. He's the director of the Institute of Native American Studies at the University of Georgia, as well as a professor of religion and adjunct professor of law, holding a JD from Columbia Law School and a PhD from Union Theological Seminary in New York. That Dr. Weaver wears so many hats is no surprise if you're familiar with his wide breadth of scholarly work, which focuses primarily on indigenous religious traditions, literature, and law. You may also recognize his voice from PBS's American Experience series, We Shall Remain, where he served as a historical advisor and interviewee on Cherokee removal. In his latest book, just out from the University of New Mexico Press, entitled Notes from a Miner's Canary, Essays on the State of Native America, Weaver brilliantly coheres a diverse collection of unique essays into a compelling addition to Native American studies, a field in which he plays no small role in shaping. Indeed, the first essay critically assesses the field, its many pitfalls and far greater possibilities, arguing for an independent and deeply accountable indigenous scholarly praxis. With this theoretical grounding, Weaver goes on in the following essays to explore the Indian as icon, the significance of NAGPRA, an American Indian perspective on U.S. criminality in the so-called War on Terror, an exploration of indigenous environmentalism, and even a rather unique chili recipe as an answer to the dreaded Indian questions always faced by indigenous scholars. If this seems like a lot, well, it is, but we should expect nothing less from this accomplished scholar in Native American studies. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, Dr. Weaver.
Hello.
So we're discussing your new book, Notes from a Miner's Canary, Essays on the State of Native America. It's recently released from the University of New Mexico Press. In your last major collection of essays titled Other Words, you wrote, Native American studies is by its nature two things, comparative and interdisciplinary. And in this new impressive volume of 17 essays, you certainly make good on that observation, touching on everything from ethics in Native architecture, critical analysis of federal law, indigenous hauntings of the white settler consciousness, and even a uniquely Oklahoman chili recipe. But before we get into the meat of this book, no pun intended, I want to start by asking you to tell the listeners a bit about yourself.
Well, as you know, I'm the Franklin Professor of Native American Studies at the University of Georgia. I've been, and I'm the director of the Institute of Native American Studies at Georgia. I've been here going on 9 years, and was born and raised in Oklahoma, as you know from the book, if you didn't know it already. And I've been involved in Native American studies for, oh my gosh, now over 20 years. And that was my 10th book.
What attracts you to this form of publishing, this collection of essays, as opposed to full monographs? Why do you choose to publish in this manner?
Well, I don't eschew monographs. I've published 3 monographs, if I count correctly, and have another one in the works. But what I find is that this format, and this is the second time that I've done it, allows me to do a couple of different things. One is journal articles, even in the most visible location, have limited exposure, often published in or chapters in a book. For instance, the architecture chapter that you mentioned that I wrote with my wife was published in a book on architectural ethics. It came out of a conference on architectural ethics at Arizona State, and it's the only Native piece in the volume. So it's unlikely that anyone in Native American studies would uncover it. So this format allows me to bring together disparate pieces that I have published in a variety of venues that may not be readily available or readily apparent, I guess I should say, and to bring those together with previously unpublished pieces, new pieces, And by this process, to illustrate the three major strands of my work, which is cultures and religious traditions. I have a PhD in religion. Law, I'm a lawyer and have a doctorate in the law from Columbia. And in literature, I've been very involved in literary criticism. And those are three of the real steeples of excellence, three pillars in Native American studies. And so to demonstrate this interdisciplinarity that you refer to, this kind of a project allows me to demonstrate that. And then, of course, the law and religion are in and of themselves interdisciplinary, in that they use a variety of different methodologies.
Now, as you mentioned, this book is very much written within the context of Native American studies, a field in which you play no small role in shaping. Your first chapter in this book, entitled More Light Than Heat, The Current State of Native American Studies, is very provocative, perhaps controversial assessment of the field. What do you argue in this essay, and where do you see Native American studies heading?
I'm very hopeful, actually, about where Native American studies is heading. Probably more hopeful than if you had asked me that same question 10 years ago. That chapter originally appeared as a lead essay in American Indian Quarterly when Amanda Cobb took over the editorship of AIQ. She asked me to join the board, and then she asked all of the board members to produce an essay on the state of the field. Very few of those actually eventuated. I was, I think, the first to get mine in. You get asked to do this kind of thing all the time, and I usually resist it. Because, as I say in the piece, they usually become either laundry lists that don't mean much of anything to anyone. There was this book, and this book. Or they come off as cranky rants. And there's probably a little bit of both in that chapter on my part. It's probably become best known for my statement that our field is a mess, which people have taken out of context. That's all they've taken away from it. What I said was that I argue in the piece that Native American studies is a discipline. And I say that our field is a mess. There's a lot more sloppy work done than good scholarship often. There's careerism and petty jealousies and backbiting, which is to say that it's just like any other discipline within the university, within academia. And that was the context within which I said that. But I argue strongly that Native American studies is its own discipline. It's much like religion or religious studies, in that no one would argue that religion isn't a discipline in the university, but there's no overarching methodology for religion the way there is for, say, history, with the stress on the archive, or on ethnohistory, or anthropology, with its emphasis on field work. Instead, in religion, you have anthropology of religion, you have history of religion, etc., etc. And I would argue that Native American studies is much the same way. But what it does mark it as a discipline is a commitment to Native American sovereignty and Native American community, and a methodological approach that says we approach this material from an internal perspective, trying to understand the history and experience and cultures and literatures, whatever element you want to pick, of Native America, from an internal perspective, as it would be understood by the participants themselves, rather than an external point of view imposing outside categories.
One of the paradigms you argue for in that chapter is a term that you've used elsewhere, communitism, and where you say that work in this field should be accountable, it should be honest about its politics, and in this case you see those as often intimately bound with Indian sovereignty. What does this kind of committed political scholarship look like to you?
well, as I said, committed to Native community, and as I argue more fully in my book, That the People Might Live, Native American Literatures and Native American Community, that commitment and that community can take many forms. There are, of course, urban Indians. There are tribal nations. There are forms of community that exist outside of either of those. But first and foremost, an involvement with community. But I argue more specifically in that chapter that it requires a commitment to Native American sovereignty, the sovereignty of now over 560 tribal nations within the United States.
Now, in your second chapter, you begin talking a bit about the environmental crisis in Indian culture, and you explore the contested relationship between indigenous people and the environment, and bring in traditional knowledge into the equation. Why don't you talk a bit about this and some of the backlash? In particular, I was pretty fascinated by many of the white environmentalists who express hostility to some Native aspirations of sovereignty. Can you talk a little bit about that second chapter?
Well, that second chapter, which gives the book its title, Notes from a Miner's Canary, was the lead essay in a collection that I did now many years ago in the early mid-1990s called Defending Mother Earth, Native American Perspectives on Environmental Justice. And that grew out of a conference that I organized in Denver, composed of Native American studies people, community intellectuals, and environmental activists to discuss this. And what you have is that environmentalists love Indians in the abstract. They don't always love them in the particular, especially because they create an icon out of the Indian that is environmentally perfect. And by environmentally perfect, it means that that icon conforms to what they see as modern ecological practices and whatever they deem to be the good. It's always hard for us when we idolize someone not to think that they're a good person. And by good person, we mean good person by our ethical standards. So, for instance, when the macaw on the Northwest coast decide to lift their self-imposed ban on whaling, a number of groups, environmental groups, Sea Shepherd and so forth, protest them because here they are taking on yet another big icon of the environmental movement, the whale, when in fact the macaw waited until the gray whale came off the endangered species list. They had agreed, again self-imposed, to limit their taking of whales to 5 per year. And it isn't going to be natives who are going to overhunt whales, of course. It's commercial hunters and the Japanese and so forth. Another example that I think you're aware of is that when the White Earth Recovery Project, Winona LaDuke's group in the Midwest, wanted to take over from the federal government the Tamarack National Forest, which had been carved out of their reservation, the Sierra Club objected, saying that if you take over management of it, we won't have any say in what happens there. So there's a distrust there between the largely white environmental movement and Native Americans, including Native American environmentalists like Winona LaDuke.
What about this question of Mother Earth? You kind of elaborate some of the how that the contention around that, whether that's a new concept or an old concept. How useful is that concept, and what role does it play in this discussion?
Well, as I argue, I mean, there was a book that came out shortly before I wrote that essay by a non-native scholar named Sam Gill called Mother Earth, in which Gill argued that the concept of Mother Earth was a modern fabrication, that it was taking the Earth and turning it, in Gill's own word, into a goddess, when in fact it's no such thing. It's neither new nor is it a quote-unquote goddess. The concept is a valuable one. It's probably gained some currency by the fact that it speaks of relationship, and Native American tribes generally, traditionally speaking, are extended families. And that's probably best played out in Ella Cara Deloria's book Water Lily, which is about the Dakota, for whom kinship bonds are both complex and sort of all-encompassing. To the extent that Deloria, the great aunt of Vine Deloria, says that even Wakantanka must be a relation to us, because only with another relation do we understand what our reciprocal obligations and responsibilities are to each other. So by speaking of Earth as Mother, and of course the Earth does give us life, it speaks of a kind of protective relationship, a familial relationship. And of course, with tribes that have creation myths that are emergence myths, such as in the American Southwest, which is that the tribe says that they emerged out of, from inside the Earth, it's an image of creation as birth. It's an image of the Earth as womb. So there's a very visceral and literal connection to a Mother Earth there.
And I just think, you know, you end this chapter with a very important contention, which is that even when discussing environmental justice based on traditional knowledge, tenure, and sovereignty, you say natives are not looking back to some supposed pre-contact idol. They do not want to remain static. They do not want to stop the clock of time. And that seems like that directly challenges some of the essentializing paradigms of white environmentalists.
Sure. It's not only white environmentalists, but non-natives in general, in kind of the American imagination, have wanted to keep Indians in a stasis box, to keep them somehow temporally pure and untainted by modern civilization. Perhaps the flip side of that is that Indians are never allowed to be coeval. They're never allowed to be contemporaneous in time. Not only to have not entered the 20th century or 21st century, but not to have entered the 20th century. The most classic example of that, which I use quite often, is Henry Luce, the publisher of Time magazine and Life magazine, who in the 1950s and early 1960s banned any coverage of Native stories, contemporary Native stories, from those magazines, because in his words, contemporary Natives were phonies. They were just the degraded descendants, I suppose, of those real, in inverted commas, 19th century Indians.
Now, I want to bring us up to the more contemporary period, particularly with your fifth chapter, Nagpra and the Return of the Repressed. First of all, I was hoping you can just introduce the listeners to NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, and then talk about some of the myths around NAGPRA that you seek to dispel in this chapter.
Yeah, that was that's a new piece, not previously published. But the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act was an act that was passed in 1990 after much activism and lobbying by Native nations and groups, when Congress decided to create the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, they passed past two acts. One was the national or the Native National Museum of the American Indian Act, which created was the enabling legislation for the museum and required the Smithsonian, under whose rubric that museum would be created, to repatriate or send back to tribes upon their request human remains that were culturally identifiable, and by that it meant identifiable to a specific tribal nation, human remains that the Smithsonian held. And the Smithsonian held about 19,000 sets of human remains. At the same time, they did not require the Smithsonian to repatriate any other category of material or object, because that would defeat the purpose of starting a national museum. But they passed NAGPRA, which required any entity receiving federal funds, essentially museums and universities, to again send back or repatriate to tribal nations upon demand several different categories of objects, and it set up a priority among those categories. First, again, was human remains. Next were associated funerary objects, objects that came out of graves and are identifiable with a particular burial or a particular person's burial. Then below that, non-associated funerary objects, objects that are what normally would have been found in graves and probably were, but because of bad provenance or other reasons, they are not associatable. The next category, sacred objects. Sacred objects are objects that are necessary for the performance of particular rituals or ceremonies, or are necessary for the revival of those ceremonies, because in some cases, because a museum has been holding a particular object or medicine bundle or what have you, a particular ceremony can't be performed. And then finally, in the most contested category, is cultural patrimony. These are objects of cultural significance to a particular tribal nation that don't fit any of the other prior categories. And that's the order with which museums have had to deal with this subject. So that's the basics of NAGPRA. Now, what was the second part of that question?
Yeah, the second part had to do with some of the myths. I was particularly interested when you talk about how NAGPRA is strangely conflated with land claims, and how that taps into, quote, some very deep-seated fear, guilt, and resentment. And you ask, what could be a greater fear than Indians taking back the land? How does that become associated, this very specific act of legislation, with some of these greater fears in the sort of settler consciousness?
Well, that is, to my mind, a very peculiar thing. I never would have believed it until I actually moved to Georgia and encountered this myth, that the myth is that NAGPRA allows Native nations, if a grave is found on a piece of property, that land then reverts to the tribal nation. That's the myth, that they can take back the land if there's an Indian grave on it. And I encountered this in short order no less than four times after moving to Georgia. The part of it, I believe, and I've talked this over with Native archaeologists like Irv Garrison here at UGA and Joe Watkins at the University of Oklahoma, part of it, I think, has been, and they would agree, has been deliberate myth-making on the part of developers. Because, of course, if in the course of developing a piece of property, there are graves found, there are protocols that come into effect under NAGPRA that require archaeological surveys, the proper repatriation and reburial of any human remains that are found. And developers don't want to be saddled with that. And so they've deliberately sown the myth in the public, in some cases, that it allows Indians to take back the land. And it encourages people, if a grave is found, to, as it were, sweep it under the carpet, to just cover it up or ignore it or you know, take the bones and quickly rebury them somewhere silently and not report it. But now, with the economy having gone down, I think this is less of a concern because there's far less development. But I think the developers during the early 2000s were deliberately sowing this myth.
Do you think NAGPRA has been effective?
NAGPRA has been very effective overall. It has generally done its job. There are, of course, museums that have resisted and dragged their feet. There are individual scholars who have dragged their feet. Because, of course, museums are in the business of collecting. They're not in the business of giving back. But it has changed the way archaeologists work. It has changed Native American nations' relationship to archaeologists. That doesn't mean that there still aren't controversies over particular objects. In my prior book, I wrote about the Clackamas in Oregon attempting to gain repatriation of a meteorite that they had set up and used in hunting rituals from the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And, of course, the most obvious controversy is the ancient one, the ancient skeleton found on the Washington-Oregon border, sometimes called Kennewick Man, which remains in the basement of the Burke Museum at the University of Washington. The United States government was going to repatriate it, that skeleton, to the group of tribes that demanded repatriation. It was opposed by an ad hoc group of scientists that claimed that important knowledge would be lost. And of course, any time you rebury a skeleton and place it out of, there is potential knowledge loss, although I'd argue how much important knowledge in this case. But the problem there is the definition of cultural affiliation. This was a 9,000-year-old skeleton. It was argued successfully by the scientists that that was too old to be culturally affiliated. The same is true of Mississippian remains here in the, well, in the eastern United States. They have not generally taken the position that those are culturally identifiable with modern tribes. There has been a bill in Congress that would fix this particular problem by bridging the cultural affiliation between so-called prehistoric, and by prehistoric meaning before the coming of whites, and modern groups, but it has never succeeded in being passed.
Now, I want to turn to the next very compelling piece, Turtle Goes to War, which is very historical and really helps deconstruct some of the decisions of the Bush administration in response to 9/11, pointing out that it represents a history of questions around habeas corpus and rights in the United States, especially in times of war. I'm just hoping you could tell us briefly about why you chose to write this piece and where this fits in or how you see this fitting in to the larger project you put forward in your work and in this book?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good question. After 9/11, with the executive order that created Guantanamo and military commissions and sought to place severe limits on the right of habeas corpus, I, as a lawyer and a human being and a United States citizen, was outraged. And as a Native person, I was doubly outraged because only American Indians prior to this had any real experience with military commissions, and it was not good, such as at the end of Little Crow's War, the so-called Great Sioux Uprising in the 1860s. And so I wanted to put it in the context of American Indian memory of military commissions and military justice. And I wrote it in a fit of energy after 9/11 because I wanted to do something. I then privately published it as a book. What you have in the new book is a very slight abridgment of that originally privately published, self-published book, and sent it to members of the administration and members of Congress. And so it was what I could do. I'm a lawyer and I write. So that was how it came about.
Any response from that, from sending this?
Only two people bothered to respond. One was my local member of Congress, Rosa DeLauro. I was living in Connecticut at the time, who responded. Then Senator from Delaware, Joe Biden, responded. Now Vice President, of course.
Mm-hmm. Amicably was his response?
Yes, in both cases.
Wow.
Favorably and amicably.
That's great. I want to change gears here a bit and talk a bit about Oklahoma, which looms large in this collection, whether it's a site of legal creation or contention, landscape, or a home. Why does Oklahoma factor into this collection so prominently?
Well, I was born and raised in Oklahoma, and my ancestors came to what was then Indian territory through the Trail of Tears. The last piece, which is new to this collection, deals with that transition, particularly of my family. But I was born and raised in Oklahoma, and Oklahoma is, every state, I guess, would claim this, but is in many ways sui generis because of its history with Native Americans and settlers, and it's not a unique landscape particularly, although I love the landscape. You can kind of carve up the Oklahoma landscape into pieces. The northern part of the state looks very much prairie and like Kansas. The western part of the state is dry and moving into the foothills of the Rockies and the desert southwest. The southeastern corner of the state called Little Dixie and is rivered and wooded and so forth. The northeastern corner is the foothills of the Ozarks. So there's nothing unique about the landscape the way there might be about Arizona or New Mexico. But it has a unique history as people. As I say in one of the essays, H.L. Mencken said of Americans in general that we were a commonwealth of third-rate men, that no one ever came here who was making it on their own, which is the history of American immigration, largely. That's even more true of Oklahoma, which was populated by cowboys and outlaws and grifters and grafters of all sorts. So it is a rather unique history. And then, of course, the forced removal from the southwest of the five tribes adds a whole different layer on that.
Now, I think there are a few terms in this book that people who are new to Native American studies might not be familiar with. One of them is survivance. And I wanted to ask you, how is it different than survival, and why is it so important in this discussion?
Survivance is a word, it was not coined by the Anishinaabe writer, thinker, Gerald Visner. It's a real word in French. But he repurposes it in English, thus for English coining it. He saw survival, I believe, as a largely victimist notion, although there's something noble in survival, obviously. But natives did more than just survive. And so survivance is, in his mind, a combination of the word survival and endurance, that they endured and managed to thrive.
Now, I want to talk about another literary figure, Scott Momaday, who you write a very stirring tribute to in this collection. Why did you choose to write about Scott Momaday here?
Well, Scott Momaday is considered, I think, sort of the originary figure of what has been called the American Indian Literary Renaissance, or the American Indian Renaissance. His publication of his first novel, Housemaid of Dawn, in 1968, which then won the Pulitzer Prize in 1969, the only American Indian novel yet to win the Pulitzer, really opened the door to a vast number of Native American authors, including Gerald Visner that we just talked about, but Leslie Marmon Silko and others who would be household names in Native American literature. The American public seemed hungry for it, and there's been a constant flow of fiction and poetry and other kinds of literature from Native Americans ever since. So he's important in that regard. But he has also been prolific in his own way, but also protean. He's produced important memoirs. He's produced plays. He's produced poetry. He really is an outsized figure, a larger-than-life figure in both Native American studies and Native American literature. And for the 40th anniversary of the publication of Housemaid of Dawn, Studies in American Indian Literatures, which is the main journal focusing specifically on Native Lit, asked me to consider Housemaid of Dawn and the position of Momaday in the field. And so that's how that piece came about.
Now I'm going to leave details of the chili recipe to the readers, the hungry readers. I will give a little bit of a teaser. There are no beans in this chili. It's a very unique recipe. But I did want to ask about how you open this brief chapter. You talk about the Indian questions, the questions that Native people or Native scholars on Native America, if they're addressing a non-Native audience, these questions they always seem to get. What are the Indian questions?
Oh, they're... I suppose they've diminished over time, but a sort of stock list of questions that you can imagine any group of non-natives, well-meaning, interested natives, but uninformed non-natives, asking of Indians. There are questions that we've all been asked at when we've given lectures. They range from, in my case, because I do religion, what do I think about Lynn Andrews, a leading figure in the sort of white New Age movement who plays upon Indian ritual and supposed tradition, it's a fictive tradition, to do you play the drum? I've been asked that. I know others who have. My favorite, which I think I cite in the essay, was my mentor, Homer Noley, Choctaw historian, who began a paper at the American Academy of Religion with a list of these questions. What do Indians eat? They're all kind of generic Indian questions, you see. What do Indians eat? There's no specificity involved. What do Indians believe about God? So he runs through all of these with his sort of snappy comebacks. And then at the end of his paper, the first young woman up to him asked him, what do Indians think about Thanksgiving? Now, I'll give her credit that she came in late and didn't hear that intro, but those are some of the Indian questions.
Gotcha. Now, you have a very provocative essay also called Blackface, Redface, and the Yellow Peril. And it kind of engages the role that race and ethnicity play in Native American studies. You focus particularly on the Freedmen question in the Cherokee Nation. Tell us a bit about this essay and its place here.
I don't believe I focus terribly on the Freedmen question. I believe it, I mean, it does play into it. And I believe that race has too generally been underestimated in Native American studies, as until recently in American studies in general. But what I wanted to do with that essay was internationalize primarily Native American studies, or as the organization is called, our professional organization, the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association. So I wanted to look at some of the good work being done internationally by scholars about American Indians, Native Americans. And it fits within my, with our overall discussion here, because, A, those scholars working internationally often lack the resources and access that we have here in the United States, but that often makes them more creative. And also they come without a lot of the baggage Americans bring to the subject, which makes it valuable. But also, this work, and I primarily focus on Asians working in Native American studies, is almost completely unknown to Americans. So I wanted to set up the possibility of dialogue internationally between or among scholars working on issues involving Native America.
Now, as we get towards the end here, I think I was remiss in not asking you a bit about the title of this collection, Notes from a Miner's Canary. Where does this idea of Miner's Canary come from, and what does it signify in the discussion of Native North America?
Well, it comes from Felix Cohen. Felix Cohen was a lawyer working for the Interior Department during the Roosevelt administration. He was Jewish and was terribly interested in American Indians. He had been involved in reform movements and so forth. When he came along, federal Indian law, the laws of the federal government relating to Native Americans, had been reduced pretty much since the Lone Wolf decision, Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock in 1903, to just the plenary power of Congress, decided by the courts. It stems from the Constitution, but it says that Congress has full or complete or total power over American Indians, that they can do anything. It becomes a political question. And some vague sense of a guardian ward relationship between the federal government and natives. And he wrote in the early 1940s, late 1930s, early 1940s, the Handbook of Federal Indian Law, which was an attempt to restate and codify federal law regarding tribal nations. And he really re-injected into the law some sense of tribal sovereignty. Before him, this was all virtually gone. And he said that the American Indian in the United States played essentially the same role that the Jews played in Europe. They were the canaries in the coal mine, marking the shift between the fresh air of democracy and the poisonous air of dictatorship and oppression. And so that's where the title comes from, Notes from a Miner's Canary. Hmm.
Now, we've been discussing Notes from a Miner's Canary, Essays on the State of Native America by Jace Weaver, just out from the University of New Mexico Press. We've taken up a lot of your time today, but I want to ask you, by way of conclusion, what are you working on now?
Well, two things, one of which is almost reached completion, and the other one hopefully will be done sometime in the fall. My wife and I have written a book on Cherokee removal that is part of a series called Reacting to the Past. And it's a method of teaching that was developed at Columbia University in New York that uses game playing and sophisticated role play to teach about critical moments in history. That is now up on a proprietary website. It's awaiting publication in hard copy and should be out sometime in the fall. And then the monograph, the fourth monograph that I referred to, is called The Red Atlantic and looks at the interaction of Native Americans and their movement around the Atlantic Basin from the earliest times, in sort of the year 1000, when the Vikings crossed, up until 1927, when Lindbergh's flight changed forever how everyone, Native and non-Native, interacted with that ocean. But it really is to fill in a gap in so-called Atlantic world studies, which has ignored or minimized the role of Natives in this cultural interchange, in this circulation of ideas and peoples around the Atlantic Basin, and really is meant to put them at the center of this discussion in the way that Paul Gilroy's book in the early 1990s, The Black Atlantic, placed Africans and African Americans back at the center of this discussion when it had been a largely a discussion of white Europeans and white colonists.
Well, that sounds great. We hope maybe we can interview you about those publications when they do come out.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Jace Weaver, for discussing Notes from a Miner's Canary, Essays on the State of Native America. Very much appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Jace Weaver, author of Notes from a Miner's Canary, Essays on the State of Native America. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com or track us down on our Facebook page, where you can leave questions, comments, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear discussed on this program. I'm Andrew Epstein from New Books in Native American Studies from the New Books Network, and we hope you join us again. Thanks.